Chapter 7. They do not sleep. On yonder cliffs, a grisly band, I see them sit. Gray. 'Twould be neglecting a warning that is given for our good to lie hid any longer, said Hawkeye, when such sounds are raised in the forest. The gentle ones may keep close, but the Mohicans and I will watch upon the rock, where I suppose a major of the 60th would wish to keep us company. Is then our danger so pressing? Asked Cora. He who makes strange sounds and gives them out for man's information alone knows our danger. I should think myself wicked, unto rebellion against his will was I to burrow with such warnings in the air. Even the weak soul who passes his days in singing is stirred by the cry, and, as he says, is ready to go forth to the battle. If 'twere only a battle, it would be a thing understood by us all and easily managed. But I have heard that when such shrieks are atween heaven and earth, it betokens another sort of warfare.
If all our reasons for fear, my friend, are confined to such as proceed from supernatural causes, we have but little occasion to be alarmed, continued the undisturbed Cora. Are you certain that our enemies have not invented some new and ingenious method to strike us with terror, that their conquest may become more easy?
Lady, returned the scout solemnly, I have listened to all the sounds of the woods for 30 years, as a man will listen whose life and death depend on the quickness of his ears. There is no whine of the panther, no whistle of the catbird, nor any invention of the devilish Mingos that can cheat me. I have heard the forest moan like mortal men in their affliction. Often and again have I listened to the wind playing its music in the branches of the girdled trees. And I have heard the lightning cracking in the air like the snapping of blazing brush as it spitted forth sparks and forked flames. But never have I thought that I heard more than the pleasure of him who sported with the things of his hand. But neither the Mohicans nor I, who am a white man without a cross, can explain the cry just heard. We therefore believe it a sign given for our good.
It is extraordinary, said Hayward, taking his pistols from the place where he had laid them on entering. Be it a sign of peace or a signal of war, it must be looked to. Lead the way, my friend. I follow.
On issuing from their place of confinement, the whole party instantly experienced a grateful renovation of spirits by exchanging the pent air of the hiding place for the cool and invigorating atmosphere which played around the whirlpools and pitches of the cataract. A heavy evening breeze swept along the surface of the river, and seemed to drive the roar of the falls into the recesses of their own caverns, whence it issued heavily and constant, like thunder rumbling beyond the distant hills. The moon had risen, and its light was already glancing here and there on the waters above them, but the extremity of the rock where they stood still lay in shadow, with the exception of the sounds produced by the rushing waters, and an occasional breathing of the air as it murmured past them in fitful currents. The scene was as still as night and solitude could make it. In vain were the eyes of each individual bent along the opposite shores, in quest of some signs of life that might explain the nature of the interruption they had heard. Their anxious and eager looks were baffled by the deceptive light, or rested only on naked rocks and straight and immovable trees. "There is nothing to be seen but the gloom and quiet of a lovely evening," whispered Duncan. "How much should we prize such a scene and all this breathing solitude at any other moment, Cora? Fancy yourselves in security, and what now, perhaps, increases your terror may be made conducive to enjoyment."
"Listen,"
interrupted Alice. The caution was unnecessary. Once more the same sound arose as if from the bed of the river, and having broken out of the narrow bounds of the cliffs, was heard undulating through the forest in distant and dying cadences.
"Can any here give name to such a cry?" demanded Hawkeye, when the last echo was lost in the woods. "If so, let him speak. For myself, I judge it not to belong to earth."
"Here, then, is one who can undeceive you," said Duncan.
"I know the sound full well, for often have I heard it on the field of battle, and in situations which are frequent in a soldier's life. 'Tis the horrid shriek that a horse will give in his agony, oftener drawn from him in pain, though sometimes in terror. My charger is either a prey to the beasts of the forest, or he sees his danger without the power to avoid it. The sound might deceive me in the cavern, but in the open air I know it too well to be wrong."
The scout and his companions listened to this simple explanation with the interest of men who imbibe new ideas at the same time that they get rid of old ones which had proved disagreeable inmates. The two latter uttered their usual and expressive exclamation, "Huh!" as the truth first glanced upon their minds, while the former, after a short musing pause, took upon himself to reply. "I cannot deny your words," he said, "for I am little skilled in horses, though born where they abound. The wolves must be hovering above their heads on the bank, and the timorsome creatures are calling on man for help in the best manner they are able. Uncas," he spoke in Delaware, "Uncas, drop down in the canoe and whirl a brand among the pack, or fear may do what the wolves can't get at to perform, and leave us without horses in the morning, when we shall have so much need to journey swiftly." The young native had already descended to the water to comply, when a long howl was raised on the edge of the river, and was borne swiftly off into the depths of the forest, as though the beasts, of their own accord, were abandoning their prey in sudden terror. Uncas, with instinctive quickness, receded, and the three foresters held another of their low, earnest conferences. "We have been like hunters who have lost the points of the heavens, and from whom the sun has been hid for days," said Hawkeye, turning away from his companions. "Now we begin again to know the signs of our course, and the paths are cleared from briars. Seat yourselves in the shade which the moon throws from yonder beach. 'Tis thicker than that of the pines, and let us wait for that which the Lord may choose to send next. Let all your conversation be in whispers, though it would be better and perhaps in the end wiser if each one held discourse with his own thoughts for a time." The manner of the scout was seriously impressive, though no longer distinguished by any signs of unmanly apprehension. It was evident that his momentary weakness had vanished with the explanation of a mystery which his own experience had not served to fathom, and though he now felt all the realities of their actual condition, that he was prepared to meet them with the energy of his hardy nature. This feeling seemed also common to the natives, who placed themselves in positions which commanded a full view of both shores, while their own persons were effectually concealed from observation. In such circumstances, common prudence dictated that Hayward and his companions should imitate a caution that proceeded from so intelligent a source. The young man drew a pile of the sassafras from the cave, and placing it in the chasm which separated the two caverns, it was occupied by the sisters, who were thus protected by the rocks from any missiles, while their anxiety was relieved by the assurance that no danger could approach without a warning. Hayward himself was posted at hand, so near that he might communicate with his companions without raising his voice to a dangerous elevation, while David, in imitation of the woodsman, bestowed his person in such a manner among the fissures of the rocks that his ungainly limbs were no longer offensive to the eye. In this manner, hours passed by without further interruption. The moon reached the zenith, and shed its mild light perpendicularly on the lovely sight of the sisters slumbering peacefully in each other's arms. Duncan cast the wide shawl of Cora before a spectacle he so much loved to contemplate, and then suffered his own head to seek a pillow on the rock. David began to utter sounds that would have shocked his delicate organs in more wakeful moments. In short, all but Hawkeye and the Mohicans lost every idea of consciousness in uncontrollable drowsiness. But the watchfulness of these vigilant protectors neither tired nor slumbered. Immovable as that rock of which each appeared to form a part, they lay, with their eyes roving, without intermission, along the dark margin of trees that bounded the adjacent shores of the narrow stream. Not a sound escaped them. The most subtle examination could not have told they breathed. It was evident that this excess of caution proceeded from an experience that no subtlety on the part of their enemies could deceive. It was, however, continued without any apparent consequences until the moon had set, and the pale streak above the treetops at the bend of the river a little below announced the approach of day. Then, for the first time, Hawkeye was seen to stir. He crawled along the rock and shook Duncan from his heavy slumbers. "Now is the time to journey," he whispered. "Awake the gentle ones and be ready to get into the canoe when I bring it to the landing place." "Have you had a quiet night?" said Hayward. "For myself, I believe sleep has got the better of my vigilance." "All is yet still as midnight. Be silent, but be quick." By this time Duncan was thoroughly awake,
and he immediately lifted the shawl from the sleeping females. The motion caused Cora to raise her hand as if to repulse him, while Alice murmured in her soft, gentle voice,
"No, no, dear father, we were not deserted. Duncan was with us."
"Yes, sweet innocence," whispered the youth. "Duncan is here, and while life continues or danger remains, he will never quit thee. Cora, Alice, awake. The hour has come to move." A loud shriek from the younger of the sisters, and the form of the other standing upright before him in bewildered horror, was the unexpected answer he received. While the words were still on the lips of Hayward, there had arisen such a tumult of yells and cries as served to drive the swift currents of his own blood back from its bounding course into the fountains of his heart. It seemed, for near a minute, as if demons of hell had possessed themselves of the air about them and were venting their savage humors in barbarous sounds. The cries came from no particular direction, though it was evident they filled the woods, and as the appalled listeners easily imagined, the caverns of the falls, the rocks, the bed of the river, and the upper air. David raised his tall person in the midst of the infernal din with a hand on either ear, exclaiming, "Whence comes this discord? Has hell broke loose that man should utter sounds like these?" The bright flashes and the quick reports of a dozen rifles from the opposite banks of the stream followed this incautious exposure of his person and left the unfortunate singing master senseless on that rock where he had been so long slumbering. The Mohicans boldly sent back the intimidating yell of their enemies, who raised a shout of savage triumph at the fall of Gamut. The flash of rifles was then quick and close between them, but either party was too well skilled to leave even a limb exposed to the hostile aim. Duncan listened with intense anxiety for the strokes of the paddle, believing that flight was now their only refuge. The river glanced by with its ordinary velocity, but the canoe was nowhere to be seen on its dark waters. He had just fancied they were cruelly deserted by the scout, as a stream of flame issued from the rock beneath him, and a fierce yell blended with a shriek of agony announced that the messenger of death sent from the fatal weapon of Hawkeye had found a victim. At this slight repulse, the assailants instantly withdrew, and gradually the place became as still as before the sudden tumult. Duncan seized the favorable moment to spring to the body of Gamut, which he bore within the shelter of the narrow chasm that protected the sisters. In another minute, the whole party was collected in this spot of comparative safety. "The poor fellow has saved his scalp," said Hawkeye, coolly passing his hand over the head of David. "But he is a proof that a man may be born with too long a tongue. 'Twas downright madness to show 6 feet of flesh and blood on a naked rock to the raging savages. I only wonder he has escaped with his life."
"Is he not dead?" demanded Cora,
in a voice whose husky tones showed how powerfully natural horror struggled with her assumed firmness.
"Can we do aught to assist the wretched man?"
"No, no. The life is in his heart yet. And after he has slept a while, he will come to himself, and be a wiser man for it, till the hour of his real time shall come," returned Hawkeye, casting another oblique glance at the insensible body, while he filled his charger with admirable nicety. "Carry him in, Uncas, and lay him on the sassafras. The longer his nap lasts, the better it will be for him, as I doubt whether he can find a proper cover for such a shape on these rocks, and singing won't do any good with the Iroquois." "You believe, then, the attack will be renewed?" said Hayward. "Do I expect a hungry wolf will satisfy his craving with a mouthful? They have lost a man, and 'tis their fashion when they meet a loss and fail in the surprise to fall back. But we shall have them on again, with new expedients to circumvent us and master our scalps. Our main hope," he continued, raising his rugged countenance, across which a shade of anxiety just then passed like a darkening cloud, "will be to keep the rock until Monroe can send a party to our help. God send it may be soon, and under a leader that knows the Indian customs." "You hear our probable fortunes, Cora," said Duncan, "and you know we have everything to hope from the anxiety and experience of your father. Come, then, with Alice into this cavern, where you at least will be safe from the murderous rifles of our enemies, and where you may bestow a care suited to your gentle natures on our unfortunate comrade." The sisters followed him into the outer cave, where David was beginning, by his sighs, to give symptoms of returning consciousness.
and then commending the wounded man to their attention, he immediately prepared to leave them.
"Duncan,"
said the tremulous voice of Cora, when he had reached the mouth of the cavern. He turned and beheld the speaker, whose color had changed to a deadly paleness, and whose lip quivered, gazing after him with an expression of interest which immediately recalled him to her side.
"Remember, Duncan, how necessary your safety is to our own, how you bear a father's sacred trust, how much depends on your discretion and care. In short," she added,
while the telltale blood stole over her features, crimsoning her very temples,
"how very deservedly dear you are to all of the name of Monroe."
"If anything could add to my own base love of life," said Hayward, suffering his unconscious eyes to wander to the youthful form of the silent Alice, "it would be so kind an assurance. As Major of the 60th, our honest host will tell you I must take my share of the fray, but our task will be easy. It is merely to keep these bloodhounds at bay for a few hours." Without waiting for reply, he tore himself from the presence of the sisters, and joined the scout and his companions, who still lay within the protection of the little chasm between the two caves.
"I tell you, Uncas," said the former, as Hayward joined them, "you are wasteful of your powder, and the kick of the rifle disconcerts your aim. Little powder, light lead, and a long arm seldom fail of bringing the death screech from a Mingo. At least, such has been my experience with the creatures. Come, friends, let us to our covers, for no man can tell when or where a Maqua will strike his blow."
The Indians silently repaired to their appointed stations, which were fissures in the rocks, whence they could command the approaches to the foot of the falls. In the center of the little island, a few short and stunted pines had found root, forming a thicket into which Hawkeye darted with the swiftness of a deer, followed by the active Duncan. Here they secured themselves, as well as circumstances would permit, among the shrubs and fragments of stone that were scattered about the place. Above them was a bare rounded rock on each side of which the water played its gambols and plunged into the abysses beneath in the manner already described. As the day had now dawned, the opposite shores no longer presented a confused outline, but they were able to look into the woods and distinguish objects beneath the canopy of gloomy pines. A long and anxious watch succeeded, but without any further evidences of a renewed attack, and Duncan began to hope that their fire had proved more fatal than was supposed, and that their enemies had been effectually repulsed. When he ventured to utter this impression to his companion, it was met by Hawkeye with an incredulous shake of the head.
"You know not the nature of a Maqua if you think he is so easily beaten back without a scalp," he answered. "If there was one of the imps yelling this morning, there were 40. And they know our number and quality too well to give up the chase so soon.
Hist! Look into the water above, just where it breaks over the rocks. I am no mortal if the risky devils haven't swam down upon the very pitch, and as bad luck would have it, they have hit the head of the island.
Hist, man! Keep close, or the hair will be off your crown in the turning of a knife."
Hayward lifted his head from the cover, and beheld what he justly considered a prodigy of rashness and skill. The river had worn away the edge of the soft rock in such a manner as to render its first pitch less abrupt and perpendicular than is usual at waterfalls. With no other guide than the ripple of the stream where it met the head of the island, a party of their insatiable foes had ventured into the current and swam down upon this point, knowing the ready access it would give, if successful, to their intended victims. As Hawkeye ceased speaking, 4 human heads could be seen peering above a few logs of driftwood that had lodged on these naked rocks, and which had probably suggested the idea of the practicability of the hazardous undertaking. At the next moment, a 5th form was seen floating over the green edge of the fall, a little from the line of the island. The savage struggled powerfully to gain the point of safety, and, favored by the glancing water, he was already stretching forth an arm to meet the grasp of his companions, when he shot away again with the whirling current, appeared to rise into the air with uplifted arms and starting eyeballs, and fell with a sullen plunge into that deep and yawning abyss over which he hovered. A single, wild, despairing shriek rose from the cavern, and all was hushed again as the grave. The first generous impulse of Duncan was to rush to the rescue of the hapless wretch, but he felt himself bound to the spot by the iron grasp of the immovable scout.
"Would you bring certain death upon us by telling the Mingos where we lie?" demanded Hawkeye sternly. "'Tis a charge of powder saved, and ammunition is as precious now as breath to a worried deer. Freshen the priming of your pistols. The mist of the falls is apt to dampen the brimstone. And stand firm for a close struggle while I fire on their rush." He placed his finger in his mouth and drew a long, shrill whistle which was answered from the rocks that were guarded by the Mohicans. Duncan caught glimpses of heads above the scattered driftwood as this signal rose on the air, but they disappeared again as suddenly as they had glanced upon his sight. A low, rustling sound next drew his attention behind him, and turning his head, he beheld Uncas within a few feet, creeping to his side. Hawkeye spoke to him in Delaware, when the young chief took his position with singular caution and undisturbed coolness. To Hayward, this was a moment of feverish and impatient suspense, though the scout saw fit to select it as a fit occasion to read a lecture to his more youthful associates on the art of using firearms with discretion. "Of all weapons," he commenced, "the long-barreled, true-grooved, soft-metalled rifle is the most dangerous in skillful hands, though it wants a strong arm, a quick eye, and great judgment in charging to put forth all its beauties. The gunsmiths can have but little insight into their trade when they make their fowling pieces and short horsemen's." He was interrupted by the low but expressive, "Huh," of Uncas. "I see them, boy, I see them," continued Hawkeye. "They are gathering for the rush, or they would keep their dingy backs below the logs. Well, let them," he added, examining his flint. "The leading man certainly comes on to his death, though it should be Montcalm himself." At that moment the woods were filled with another burst of cries, and at the signal four savages sprang from the cover of the driftwood. Hayward felt a burning desire to rush forward to meet them, so intense was the delirious anxiety of the moment. But he was restrained by the deliberate examples of the scout and Uncas. When their foes, who leaped over the black rock that divided them, with long bounds, uttering the wildest yells, were within a few rods, the rifle of Hawkeye slowly rose among the shrubs and poured out its fatal contents. The foremost Indian bounded like a stricken deer and fell headlong among the clefts of the island. "Now, Uncas," cried the scout, drawing his long knife, while his quick eyes began to flash with ardor, "take the last of the screeching imps. Of the other two, we are certain." He was obeyed, and but two enemies remained to be overcome. Hayward had given one of his pistols to Hawkeye, and together they rushed down a little declivity toward their foes. They discharged their weapons at the same instant, and equally without success. "I knowed it, and I said it," muttered the scout, whirling the despised little implement over the falls with bitter disdain. "Come on, ye bloody-minded hellhounds! Ye meet a man without a cross!" The words were barely uttered when he encountered a savage of gigantic stature and of the fiercest mien. At the same moment, Duncan found himself engaged with the other, in a similar contest of hand to hand. With ready skill, Hawkeye and his antagonist each grasped that uplifted arm of the other which held the dangerous knife. For near a minute they stood looking one another in the eye, and gradually exerting the power of their muscles for the mastery. At length, the toughened sinews of the white man prevailed over the less practiced limbs of the native. The arm of the latter slowly gave way before the increasing force of the scout, who, suddenly wresting his armed hand from the grasp of the foe, drove the sharp weapon through his naked bosom to the heart. In the meantime, Hayward had been pressed in a more deadly struggle. His slight sword was snapped in the first encounter. As he was destitute of any other means of defense, his safety now depended entirely on bodily strength and resolution. Though deficient in neither of these qualities, he had met an enemy every way his equal. Happily, he soon succeeded in disarming his adversary, whose knife fell on the rock at their feet, and from this moment it became a fierce struggle. Who should cast the other over the dizzy height into a neighboring cavern of the falls? Every successive struggle brought them nearer to the verge, where Duncan perceived the final and conquering effort must be made. Each of the combatants threw all his energies into that effort, and the result was that both tottered on the brink of the precipice. Hayward felt the grasp of the other at his throat, and saw the grim smile the savage gave, under the revengeful hope that he hurried his enemy to a fate similar to his own, as he felt his body slowly yielding to a resistless power, and the young man experienced the passing agony of such a moment in all its horrors. At that instant of extreme danger, a dark hand and glancing knife appeared before him. The Indian released his hold as the blood flowed freely from around the severed tendons of the wrist, and while Duncan was drawn backward by the saving arm of Uncas, his charmed eyes were still riveted on the fierce and disappointed countenance of his foe, who fell sullenly and disappointed down the irrecoverable precipice. "To cover! To cover!" cried Hawkeye, who just then had dispatched the enemy. "To cover for your lives! The work is but half ended." The young Mohican gave a shout of triumph, and followed by Duncan, he glided up the acclivity they had descended to the combat, and sought the friendly shelter of the rocks and shrubs.
Chapter 8 They linger yet, avengers of their native land. Gray. The warning call of the scout was not uttered without occasion. During the occurrence of the deadly encounter just related, the roar of the falls was unbroken by any human sound whatever. It would seem that interest in the result had kept the natives on the opposite shores in breathless suspense, while the quick evolutions and swift changes in the position of the combatants effectually prevented a fire that might prove dangerous alike to friend and enemy. But the moment the struggle was decided, a yell arose as fierce and savage as wild and revengeful passions could throw into the air. It was followed by the swift flashes of the rifles, which sent their leaden messengers across the rock in volleys, as though the assailants would pour out their impotent fury on the insensible scene of the fatal contest. A steady, though deliberate, return was made from the rifle of Chingachgook, who had maintained his post throughout the fray with unmoved resolution. When the triumphant shout of Uncas was borne to his ears, the gratified father raised his voice in a single responsive cry, after which his busy piece alone proved that he still guarded his pass with unwearied diligence. In this manner many minutes flew by with the swiftness of thought, the rifles of the assailants speaking at times in rattling volleys, and at others in occasional scattering shots. Though the rock, the trees, and the shrubs were cut and torn in 100 places around the besieged, their cover was so close and so rigidly maintained that, as yet, David had been the only sufferer in their little band. "Let them burn their powder," said the deliberate scout, while bullet after bullet whizzed by the place where he securely lay. "There will be a fine gathering of lead when it is over, and I fancy the imps will tire of the sport afore these old stones cry out for mercy. Uncas, boy, you waste the colonels by overcharging, and a kicking rifle never carries a true bullet. I told you to take that loping miscreant under the line of white paint. Now, if your bullet went a hair's breadth, it went 2 inches above it. The life lies low in a Mingo, and humanity teaches us to make a quick end of the Sarpents." A quiet smile lighted the haughty features of the young Mohican, betraying his knowledge of the English language, as well as of the other's meaning. But he suffered it to pass away without vindication or reply. "I cannot permit you to accuse Uncas of want of judgment or of skill," said Duncan. "He saved my life in the coolest and readiest manner, and he has made a friend who never will require to be reminded of the debt he owes." Uncas partly raised his body and offered his hand to the grasp of Hayward. During this act of friendship, the two young men exchanged looks of intelligence, which caused Duncan to forget the character and condition of his wild associate. In the meanwhile, Hawkeye, who looked on this burst of youthful feeling with a cool but kind regard, made the following reply. "Life is an obligation which friends often owe each other in the wilderness. I dare say I may have served Uncas some such turn myself before now, and I very well remember that he has stood between me and death 5 different times, 3 times from the Mingos, once in crossing Horican, and—"
"That bullet was better aimed than common," exclaimed Duncan, involuntarily shrinking from a shot which struck the rock at his side with a smart rebound.
Hawkeye laid his hand on the shapeless metal and shook his head as he examined it, saying, "Falling lead is never flattened. Had it come from the clouds, this might have happened." But the rifle of Uncas was deliberately raised toward the heavens, directing his companions to a point where the mystery was immediately explained. A ragged oak grew on the right bank of the river, nearly opposite to their position, which, seeking the freedom of the open space, had inclined so far forward
that its upper branches overhung that arm of the stream which flowed nearest to its own shore. Among the topmost leaves, which scantily concealed the gnarled and stunted limbs, a savage was nestled, partly concealed by the trunk of the tree, and partly exposed, as though looking down upon them to ascertain the effect produced by his treacherous aim.
"These devils will scale heaven to circumvent us to our ruin," said Hawkeye. "Keep him in play, boy, until I can bring Killdeer to bear, when we will try his mettle on each side of the tree at once."
Uncas delayed his fire until the scout uttered the word. The rifles flashed. The leaves and the bark of the oak flew into the air and were scattered by the wind. But the Indian answered their assault by a taunting laugh, sending down upon them another bullet in return that struck the cap of Hawkeye from his head. Once more the savage yells burst out of the woods, and the leaden hail whistled above the heads of the besieged, as if to confine them to a place where they might become easy victims to the enterprise of the warrior who had mounted the tree.
"This must be looked to," said the scout, glancing about him with an anxious eye. "Uncas, call up your father. We have need of all our weapons to bring the cunning varmint from his roost."
The signal was instantly given, and before Hawkeye had reloaded his rifle, they were joined by Chingachgook. When his son pointed out to the experienced warrior the situation of their dangerous enemy, the usual exclamatory, "Huh!" burst from his lips, after which no further expression of surprise or alarm was suffered to escape him. Hawkeye and the Mohicans conversed earnestly together in Delaware for a few moments, when each quietly took his post in order to execute the plan they had speedily devised. The warrior in the oak had maintained a quick, though ineffectual fire from the moment of his discovery. But his aim was interrupted by the vigilance of his enemies, whose rifles instantaneously bore on any part of his person that was left exposed. Still, his bullets fell in the center of the crouching party. The clothes of Hayward, which rendered him peculiarly conspicuous, were repeatedly cut, and once blood was drawn from a slight wound in his arm. At length, emboldened by the long and patient watchfulness of his enemies, the Huron attempted a better and more fatal aim. The quick eye of the Mohicans caught the dark line of his lower limbs incautiously exposed through the thin foliage, a few inches from the trunk of the tree. Their rifles made a common report when, sinking on his wounded limb, part of the body of the savage came into view. Swift as thought, Hawkeye seized the advantage and discharged his fatal weapon into the top of the oak. The leaves were unusually agitated. The dangerous rifle fell from its commanding elevation, and after a few moments of vain struggling, the form of the savage was seen swinging in the wind, while he still grasped a ragged and naked branch of the tree with hands clenched in desperation.
"Give him, in pity, give him the contents of another rifle," cried Duncan, turning away his eyes in horror from the spectacle of a fellow creature in such awful jeopardy.
"Not a carnal," exclaimed the obdurate Hawkeye. "His death is certain, and we have no powder to spare. For Indian fights sometimes last for days. 'Tis their scalps or ours. And God, who made us, has put into our natures the craving to keep the skin on the head."
Against this stern and unyielding morality, supported as it was by such visible policy, there was no appeal. From that moment the yells in the forest once more ceased. The fire was suffered to decline. And all eyes, those of friends as well as enemies, became fixed on the hopeless condition of the wretch who was dangling between heaven and earth. The body yielded to the currents of air, and though no murmur or groan escaped the victim, there were instants when he grimly faced his foes, and the anguish of cold despair might be traced through the intervening distance in possession of his swarthy lineaments. Three several times the scout raised his piece in mercy, and as often prudence getting the better of his intention, it was again silently lowered. At length one hand of the Huron lost its hold, and dropped exhausted to his side. A desperate and fruitless struggle to recover the branch succeeded, and then the savage was seen for a fleeting instant, grasping wildly at the empty air. The lightning is not quicker than was the flame from the rifle of Hawkeye. The limbs of the victim trembled and contracted. The head fell to the bosom, and the body parted the foaming waters like lead when the element closed above it in its ceaseless velocity, and every vestige of the unhappy Huron was lost forever. No shout of triumph succeeded this important advantage, but even the Mohicans gazed at each other in silent horror.
A single yell burst from the woods, and all was again still. Hawkeye, who alone appeared to reason on the occasion, shook his head at his own momentary weakness, even uttering his self-disapprobation aloud. "'Twas the last charge in my horn, and the last bullet in my pouch, and 'twas the act of a boy," he said. What mattered it whether he struck the rock living or dead? Feeling would soon be over. "Uncas, lad, go down to the canoe and bring up the bighorn. It is all the powder we have left, and we shall need it to the last grain, or I am ignorant of the Mingo nature." The young Mohican complied, leaving the scout turning over the useless contents of his pouch, and shaking the empty horn with renewed discontent. From this unsatisfactory examination, however, he was soon called by a loud and piercing exclamation from Uncas that sounded even to the unpracticed ears of Duncan as the signal of some new and unexpected calamity. Every thought filled with apprehension for the precious treasure he had concealed in the cavern, the young man started to his feet, totally regardless of the hazard he incurred by such an exposure. As if actuated by a common impulse, his movement was imitated by his companions, and together they rushed down the pass to the friendly chasm with a rapidity that rendered the scattering fire of their enemies perfectly harmless. The unwonted cry had brought the sisters, together with the wounded David, from their place of refuge, and the whole party, at a single glance, was made acquainted with the nature of the disaster that had disturbed even the practiced stoicism of their youthful Indian protector. At a short distance from the rock, their little bark was to be seen floating across the eddy towards the swift current of the river, in a manner which proved that its course was directed by some hidden agent. The instant this unwelcome sight caught the eye of the scout, the rifle was leveled as by instinct, but the barrel gave no answer to the bright sparks of the flint. "'Tis too late, 'tis too late," Hawkeye exclaimed, dropping the useless piece in bitter disappointment. "The miscreant has struck the rapid, and had we powder it could hardly send the lead swifter than he now goes." The adventurous Huron raised his head above the shelter of the canoe, and while it glided swiftly down the stream, he waved his hand and gave forth a shout, which was the known signal of success. His cry was answered by a yell and a laugh from the woods, as tauntingly exulting as if 50 demons were uttering their blasphemies at the fall of some Christian soul. "Well may you laugh, ye children of the devil," said the scout, seating himself on a projection of the rock, and suffering his gun to fall neglected at his feet. "For the three quickest and surest rifles in these woods are no better than so many stalks of mullein, or the last year's horns of a buck." "What is to be done?" demanded Duncan, losing the first feeling of disappointment in a more manly desire for exertion. "What will become of us?" Hawkeye made no other reply than by passing his finger around the crown of his head in a manner so significant that none who witnessed the action could mistake its meaning. "Surely, surely our case is not so desperate," exclaimed the youth. "The Hurons are not here. We may make good the caverns. We may oppose their landing." "With what?" coolly demanded the scout. "The arrows of Uncas, or such tears as women shed?" "No, no, you are young and rich, and have friends, and at such an age I know it is hard to die, but—" glancing eyes at the Mohicans. "Let us remember we are men without a cross, and let us teach these natives of the forest that white blood can run as freely as red when the appointed hour has come." Duncan turned quickly in the direction indicated by the other's eyes, and read a confirmation of his worst apprehensions in the conduct of the Indians. Chingachgook, placing himself in a dignified posture on another fragment of the rock, had already laid aside his knife and tomahawk, and was in the act of taking the eagle's plume from his head and smoothing the solitary tuft of hair in readiness to perform its last and revolting office. His countenance was composed, though thoughtful, while his dark, gleaming eyes were gradually losing the fierceness of the combat in an expression better suited to the change he expected momentarily to undergo. "Our case is not, cannot be so hopeless," said Duncan. "Even at this moment succor may be at hand. I see no enemies. They have sickened of a struggle in which they risk so much with so little prospect of gain. It may be a minute or it may be an hour afore the wily sarpents steal upon us, and it is quite in nature for them to be lying within hearing at this very moment," said Hawkeye. "But come they will, and in such a fashion as will leave us nothing to hope. Chingachgook, He spoke in Delaware. My brother, we have fought our last battle together, and the Maquas will triumph in the death of the sage man of the Mohicans, and of the pale face, whose eyes can make night as day, and level the clouds to the mists of the springs. Let the Mingo women go weep over their slain, returned the Indian, with characteristic pride and unmoved firmness. The great snake of the Mohicans has coiled himself in their wigwams, and has poisoned their triumph with the wailings of children whose fathers have not returned. 11 warriors lie hid from the graves of their tribes since the snows have melted, and none will tell where to find them when the tongue of Chingachgook shall be silent. Let them draw the sharpest knife and whirl the swiftest tomahawk, for their bitterest enemy is in their hands. Uncas, topmost branch of a noble trunk, call on the cowards to hasten, or their hearts will soften and they will change to women.
They look among the fishes for their dead, returned the low, soft voice of the youthful chieftain. The Hurons float with the slimy eels. They drop from the oaks like fruit that is ready to be eaten. And the Delawares laugh.
Aye, aye, muttered the scout, who had listened to this peculiar burst of the natives with deep attention. They have warmed their Indian feelings, and they'll soon provoke the Maquas to give them a speedy end. As for me, who am of the whole blood of the whites, it is befitting that I should die as becomes my color, with no words of scoffing in my mouth and without bitterness at the heart.
Why die at all? Said Cora,
advancing from the place where natural horror had until this moment held her riveted to the rock.
The path is open on every side. Fly then to the woods, and call on God for succor. Go, brave men. We owe you too much already. Let us no longer involve you in our hapless fortunes.
You but little know the craft of the Iroquois, lady. If you judge they have left the path open to the woods, returned Hawkeye, who, however, immediately added in his simplicity, the downstream current, it is certain, might soon sweep us beyond the reach of their rifles or the sounds of their voices.
Then try the river. Why linger to add to the number of the victims of our merciless enemies?
Why? Repeated the scout, looking about him proudly. Because it is better for a man to die at peace with himself than to live haunted by an evil conscience. What answer could we give Monroe when he asked us where and how we left his children?
Go to him and say that you left them with a message to hasten to their aid, returned Cora,
advancing nigher to the scout in her generous ardor,
that the Hurons bear them into the northern wilds, but that by vigilance and speed they may yet be rescued. And if, after all, it should please heaven that his assistance come too late, bear to him, she continued, her voice gradually lowering until it seemed nearly choked, the love, the blessings, the final prayers of his daughters, and bid him not mourn their early fate, but to look forward with humble confidence to the Christian's goal to meet his children.
The hard, weather-beaten features of the scout began to work, and when she had ended, he dropped his chin to his hand, like a man musing profoundly on the nature of the proposal. There is reason in her words, at length broke from his compressed and trembling lips. Aye, and they bear the spirit of Christianity. What might be right and proper in a redskin may be sinful in a man who has not even a cross in blood to plead for his ignorance. Chingachgook, Uncas, hear you the talk of the dark-eyed woman. He now spoke in Delaware to his companions, and his address, though calm and deliberate, seemed very decided. The elder Mohican heard him with deep gravity, and appeared to ponder on his words, as though he felt the importance of their import. After a moment of hesitation, he waved his hand in assent, and uttered the English word, good, with the peculiar emphasis of his people. Then, replacing his knife and tomahawk in his girdle, the warrior moved silently to the edge of the rock which was most concealed from the banks of the river. Here he paused a moment, pointed significantly to the woods below, and saying a few words in his own language, as if indicating his intended route, he dropped into the water, and sank from before the eyes of the witnesses of his movements. The scout delayed his departure to speak to the generous girl, whose breathing became lighter as she saw the success of her remonstrance. Wisdom is sometimes given to the young as well as to the old, he said, and what you have spoken is wise, not to call it by a better word. If you are led into the woods, that is, such of you as may be spared for a while, Break the twigs on the bushes as you pass, and make the marks of your trail as broad as you can, when, if mortal eyes can see them, depend on having a friend who will follow to the ends of Arth afore he deserts you." He gave Korra an affectionate shake of the hand, lifted his rifle, and after regarding it a moment with melancholy solicitude, laid it carefully aside, and descended to the place where Chingachgook had just disappeared. For an instant he hung suspended by the rock, and looking about him with a countenance of peculiar care, he added bitterly, "Had the powder held out, this disgrace could never have befallen." Then, loosening his hold, the water closed above his head, and he also became lost to view. All eyes were now turned on Uncas, who stood leaning against the ragged rock in immovable composure. After waiting a short time, Korra pointed down the river and said, "Your friends have not been seen, and are now most probably in safety. Is it not time for you to follow?"
"Uncas will stay," the young Mohican calmly answered in English.
"To increase the horror of our capture, and to diminish the chances of our release. Go, generous young man," Korra continued, lowering her eyes under the gaze of the Mohican, and perhaps with an intuitive consciousness of her power. "Go to my father, as I have said, and be the most confidential of my messengers. Tell him to trust you with the means to buy the freedom of his daughters. Go, 'tis my wish, 'tis my prayer that you will go."
The settled, calm look of the young chief changed to an expression of gloom, but he no longer hesitated. With a noiseless step, he crossed the rock and dropped into the troubled stream. Hardly a breath was drawn by those he left behind, until they caught a glimpse of his head emerging for air far down the current, when again he sank and was seen no more. These sudden and apparently successful experiments had all taken place in a few minutes of that time which had now become so precious. After the last look at Uncas, Korra turned, and with a quivering lip addressed herself to Hayward.
"I have heard of your boasted skill in the water too, Duncan," she said. "Follow, then, the wise example set you by these simple and faithful beings."
"Is such the faith that Korra Munro would exact from her protector?" said the young man, smiling mournfully but with bitterness.
"This is not a time for idle subtleties and false opinions," she answered, "but a moment when every duty should be equally considered. To us you can be of no further service here, but your precious life may be saved for other and nearer friends."
He made no reply, though his eyes fell wistfully on the beautiful form of Alice, who was clinging to his arm with the dependency of an infant.
"Consider," continued Korra, after a pause during which she seemed to struggle with a pang even more acute than any that her fears had excited, "that the worst to us can be but death, a tribute that all must pay at the good time of God's appointment."
"There are evils worse than death," said Duncan, speaking hoarsely, and as if fretful at her importunity, "but which the presence of one who would die in your behalf may avert."
Korra ceased her entreaties, and veiling her face in her shawl, drew the nearly insensible Alice after her into the deepest recess of the inner cavern.
Chapter 9. Be gay securely. Dispel, my fair, with smiles the timorous clouds that hang on thy clear brow. Death of Agrippina. The sudden and almost magical change from the stirring incidents of the combat to the stillness that now reigned around him acted on the heated imagination of Hayward like some exciting dream. While all the images and events he had witnessed remained deeply impressed on his memory, he felt a difficulty in persuading himself of their truth. Still ignorant of the fate of those who had trusted to the aid of the swift current, he at first listened intently to any signal or sounds of alarm which might announce the good or evil fortune of their hazardous undertaking. His attention was, however, bestowed in vain, for with the disappearance of Uncas, every sign of the adventurers had been lost, leaving him in total uncertainty of their fate. In a moment of such painful doubt, Duncan did not hesitate to look about him, without consulting that protection from the rocks which just before had been so necessary to his safety. Every effort, however, to detect the least evidence of the approach of their hidden enemies was as fruitless as the inquiry after his late companions. the wooded banks of the rivers seemed again deserted by everything possessing animal life. The uproar which had so lately echoed through the vaults of the forest was gone, leaving the rush of the waters to swell and sink on the currents of the air in the unmingled sweetness of nature. A fishhawk, which, secure on the topmost branches of a dead pine, had been a distant spectator of the fray, now stooped from his high and ragged perch and soared in wide sweeps above his prey, while a jay, whose noisy voice had been stilled by the hoarser cries of the savages, ventured again to open his discordant throat, as though once more in undisturbed possession of his wild domains. Duncan caught from these natural accompaniments of the solitary scene a glimmering of hope, and he began to rally his faculties to renewed exertions, with something like a reviving confidence of success. "The Hurons are not to be seen," he said, addressing David, who had by no means recovered from the effects of the stunning blow he had received. "Let us conceal ourselves in the cavern, and trust the rest to Providence."
"I remember to have united with two comely maidens in lifting up our voices in praise and thanksgiving," returned the bewildered singing master, "since which time I have been visited by a heavy judgment for my sins. I have been mocked with the likeness of sleep, while sounds of discord have rent my ears, such as might manifest the fullness of time, and that nature had forgotten her harmony."
"Poor fellow, thine own period was in truth near its accomplishment. But arouse and come with me. I will lead you where all other sounds but those of your own psalmody shall be excluded."
"There is melody in the fall of the cataract, and the rushing of many waters is sweet to the senses," said David, pressing his hand confusedly on his brow. "Is not the air yet filled with shrieks and cries, as though the departed spirits of the damned—"
"Not now, not now," interrupted the impatient Hayward. "They have ceased, and they who raised them, I trust in God, they are gone too. Everything but the water is still and at peace. In, then, where you may create those sounds you love so well to hear." David smiled sadly, though not without a momentary gleam of pleasure at this allusion to his beloved vocation. He no longer hesitated to be led to a spot which promised such unalloyed gratification to his wearied senses, and, leaning on the arm of his companion, he entered the narrow mouth of the cave. Duncan seized a pile of sassafras, which he drew before the passage, studiously concealing every appearance of an aperture. Within this fragile barrier he arranged the blankets abandoned by the foresters, darkening the inner extremity of the cavern, while its outer received a chastened light from the narrow ravine through which one arm of the river rushed to form the junction with its sister branch a few rods below.
"I like not that principle of the natives, which teaches them to submit without a struggle in emergencies that appear desperate," he said while busied in this employment. "Our own maxim, which says, 'While life remains, there is hope,' is more consoling, and better suited to a soldier's temperament. To you, Cora, I will urge no words of idle encouragement. Your own fortitude and undisturbed reason will teach you all that may become your sex. But cannot we dry the tears of that trembling weeper on your bosom?"
"I am calmer, Duncan," said Alice,
raising herself from the arms of her sister, and forcing an appearance of composure through her tears.
"Much calmer now. Surely in this hidden spot we are safe, we are secret, free from injury. We will hope everything from those generous men who have risked so much already in our behalf."
"Now does our gentle Alice speak like a daughter of Monroe," said Hayward, pausing to press her hand as he passed towards the outer entrance of the cavern. "With two such examples of courage before him, a man would be ashamed to prove other than a hero."
He then seated himself in the center of the cavern, grasping his remaining pistol with a hand convulsively clenched, while his contracted and frowning eye announced the sullen desperation of his purpose. "The Hurons, if they come, may not gain our position so easily as they think," he lowly muttered, and dropping his head back against the rock, he seemed to await the result in patience, though his gaze was unceasingly bent on the open avenue to their place of retreat. With the last sound of his voice, a deep, a long, and almost breathless silence succeeded. The fresh air of the morning had penetrated the recess,
and its influence was gradually felt on the spirits of its inmates. As minute after minute passed by, leaving them in undisturbed security, the insinuating feeling of hope was gradually gaining possession of every bosom, though each one felt reluctant to give utterance to expectations that the next moment might so fearfully destroy. David alone formed an exception to these varying emotions. A gleam of light from the opening crossed his wan countenance and fell upon the pages of the little volume, whose leaves he was again occupied in turning, as if searching for some song more fitted to their condition than any that had yet met his eye. He was, most probably, acting all this time under a confused recollection of the promised consolation of Duncan. At length, it would seem, his patient industry found its reward, for without explanation or apology, he pronounced aloud the words Isle of Wight, drew a long sweet sound from his pitch-pipe, and then ran through the preliminary modulations of the air, whose name he had just mentioned, with the sweeter tones of his own musical voice.
"May not this prove dangerous?"
asked Cora, glancing her dark eye at Major Hayward.
"Poor fellow. His voice is too feeble to be heard amid the din of the falls," was the answer. "Besides, the cavern will prove his friend. Let him indulge his passion, since it may be done without hazard."
"Isle of Wight," repeated David, looking about him with that dignity with which he had long been wont to silence the whispering echoes of his school. "'Tis a brave tune, and set to solemn words. Let it be sung with meet respect."
After allowing a moment of stillness to enforce his discipline, the voice of the singer was heard, in low, murmuring syllables, gradually stealing on the ear, until it filled the narrow vault with sounds rendered trebly thrilling by the feeble and tremulous utterance produced by his debility. The melody, which no weakness could destroy, gradually wrought its sweet influence on the senses of those who heard it. It even prevailed over the miserable travesty of the Song of David, which the singer had selected from a volume of similar effusions, and caused the sense to be forgotten in the insinuating harmony of the sounds. Alice unconsciously dried her tears, and bent her melting eyes on the pallid features of Gamut with an expression of chastened delight that she neither affected nor wished to conceal. Cora bestowed an approving smile on the pious efforts of the namesake of the Jewish prince, and Hayward soon turned his steady stern look from the outlet of the cavern to fasten it with a milder character on the face of David, or to meet the wandering beams which at moments strayed from the humid eyes of Alice. The open sympathy of the listeners stirred the spirit of the votary of music, whose voice regained its richness and volume without losing that touching softness which proved its secret charm. Exerting his renovated powers to their utmost, he was yet filling the arches of the cave with long and full tones, when a yell burst into the air without, that instantly stilled his pious strains, choking his voice suddenly, as though his heart had literally bounded into the passage of his throat.
"We are lost!"
exclaimed Alice, throwing herself into the arms of Cora.
"Not yet, not yet," returned the agitated but undaunted Hayward. "The sound came from the center of the island, and it has been produced by the sight of their dead companions. We are not yet discovered, and there is still hope."
Faint and almost despairing as was the prospect of escape, the words of Duncan were not thrown away, for it awakened the powers of the sisters in such a manner that they awaited the result in silence. A second yell soon followed the first, when a rush of voices was heard pouring down the island from its upper to its lower extremity until they reached the naked rock above the caverns, where, after a shout of savage triumph, the air continued full of horrible cries and screams, such as man alone can utter, and he only when in a state of the fiercest barbarity. The sounds quickly spread around them in every direction. Some called to their fellows from the water's edge and were answered from the heights above. Cries were heard in the startling vicinity of the chasm between the two caves, which mingled with hoarser yells that arose out of the abyss of the deep ravine. In short, so rapidly had the savage sounds diffused themselves over the barren rock that it was not difficult for the anxious listeners to imagine they could be heard beneath, as in truth they were above and on every side of them. In the midst of this tumult,
A triumphant yell was raised within a few yards of the hidden entrance to the cave. Hayward abandoned every hope, with the belief that it was the signal that they were discovered. Again the impression passed away, as he heard the voices collect near the spot where the white man had so reluctantly abandoned his rifle. Amid the jargon of the Indian dialects that he now plainly heard, it was easy to distinguish not only words, but sentences in the patois of the Canadas. A burst of voices had shouted simultaneously, "La Longue Carabine," causing the opposite woods to re-echo with a name which, Hayward well remembered, had been given by his enemies to a celebrated hunter and scout of the English camp, and who, he now learned for the first time, had been his late companion. "La Longue Carabine! La Longue Carabine!" passed from mouth to mouth until the whole band appeared to be collected around the trophy which would seem to announce the death of its formidable owner. After a vociferous consultation, which was at times deafened by bursts of savage joy, they again separated, filling the air with the name of a foe whose body, Hayward could collect from their expressions, they hoped to find concealed in some crevice of the island. "Now," he whispered to the trembling sisters, "now is the moment of uncertainty. If our place of retreat escape this scrutiny, we are still safe. In every event, we are assured by what has fallen from our enemies that our friends have escaped, and in 2 short hours we may look for succor from Webb." There were now a few minutes of fearful stillness, during which Hayward well knew that the savages conducted their search with greater vigilance and method. More than once he could distinguish their footsteps as they brushed the sassafras, causing the faded leaves to rustle and the branches to snap. At length the pile yielded a little. A corner of the blanket fell, and a faint ray of light gleamed into the inner part of the cave. Cora folded Alice to her bosom in agony, and Duncan sprang to his feet. A shout was at that moment heard, as if issuing from the center of the rock, announcing that the neighboring cavern had at length been entered. In a minute, the number and loudness of the voices indicated that the whole party was collected in and around that secret place. As the inner passages to the 2 caves were so close to each other, Duncan, believing that escape was no longer possible, passed David and the sisters to place himself between the latter and the first onset of the terrible meeting. Grown desperate by his situation, he drew nigh the slight barrier which separated him only by a few feet from his relentless pursuers, and placing his face to the casual opening, he even looked out with a sort of desperate indifference on their movements. Within reach of his arm was the brawny shoulder of a gigantic Indian, whose deep and authoritative voice appeared to give directions to the proceedings of his fellows. Beyond him again, Duncan could look into the vault opposite, which was filled with savages, upturning and rifling the humble furniture of the scout. The wound of David had dyed the leaves of sassafras with a color that the natives well knew was anticipating the season. Over this sign of their success they set up a howl, like an opening from so many hounds who had recovered a lost trail. After this yell of victory they tore up the fragrant bed of the cavern and bore the branches into the chasm, scattering the boughs as if they suspected them of concealing the person of the man they had so long hated and feared. One fierce and wild-looking warrior approached the chief bearing a load of the brush, and pointing exultingly to the deep red stains with which it was sprinkled, uttered his joy in Indian yells, whose meaning Hayward was only enabled to comprehend by the frequent repetition of the name of La Longue Carabine. When his triumph had ceased, he cast the brush on the slight heap that Duncan had made before the entrance of the second cavern and closed the view. His example was followed by others, who, as they drew the branches from the cave of the scout, threw them into one pile, adding unconsciously to the security of those they sought. The very slightness of the defense was its chief merit, for no one thought of disturbing a mass of brush which all of them believed in that moment of hurry and confusion had been accidentally raised by the hands of their own party. As the blankets yielded before the outward pressure, and the branches settled in the fissure of the rock by their own weight, forming a compact body, Duncan once more breathed freely. With a light step and lighter heart, he returned to the center of the cave and took the place he had left, where he could command a view of the opening next the river. While he was in the act of making this movement, the Indians,
as if changing their purpose by a common impulse, broke away from the cavern in a body, and were heard rushing up the island again towards the point whence they had originally descended. Here another wailing cry betrayed that they were again collected around the bodies of their dead comrades. Duncan now ventured to look at his companions, for during the most critical moments of their danger, he had been apprehensive that the anxiety of his countenance might communicate some additional alarm to those who were so little able to sustain it. "They are gone, Cora," he whispered. "Alice, they are returned whence they came, and we are saved. To heaven, that has alone delivered us from the grasp of so merciless an enemy, be all the praise."
"Then to heaven will I return my thanks,"
exclaimed the younger sister, rising from the encircling arms of Cora, and casting herself with enthusiastic gratitude on the naked rock.
"To that heaven who has spared the tears of a gray-headed father, has saved the lives of those I so much love."
Both Hayward and the more tempered Cora witnessed the act of involuntary emotion with powerful sympathy, the former secretly believing that piety had never worn a form so lovely as it now had assumed in the youthful person of Alice, her eyes radiant with the glow of grateful feelings. The flush of her beauty was again seated on her cheeks, and her whole soul seemed ready and anxious to pour out its thanksgivings through the medium of her eloquent features. But when her lips moved, the words they should have uttered appeared frozen by some new and sudden chill. Her bloom gave place to the paleness of death. Her soft and melting eyes grew hard and seemed contracting with horror, while those hands which she had raised, clasped in each other towards heaven, dropped in horizontal lines before her, the fingers pointed forward in convulsed motion. Hayward turned the instant she gave a direction to his suspicions, and, peering just above the ledge which formed the threshold of the open outlet of the cavern, he beheld the malignant, fierce, and savage features of Le Renard Subtil. In that moment of surprise, the self-possession of Hayward did not desert him. He observed by the vacant expression of the Indian's countenance that his eye, accustomed to the open air, had not yet been able to penetrate the dusky light which pervaded the depth of the cavern. He had even thought of retreating beyond a curvature in the natural wall, which might still conceal him and his companions, when, by the sudden gleam of intelligence that shot across the features of the savage, he saw it was too late, and that they were betrayed. The look of exultation and brutal triumph which announced this terrible truth was irresistibly irritating. Forgetful of everything but the impulses of his hot blood, Duncan leveled his pistol and fired. The report of the weapon made the cavern bellow like an eruption from a volcano, and when the smoke it vomited had been driven away before the current of air which issued from the ravine, the place so lately occupied by the features of his treacherous guide was vacant. Rushing to the outlet, Hayward caught a glimpse of his dark figure, stealing around a low and narrow ledge which soon hid him entirely from sight. Among the savages, a frightful stillness succeeded the explosion which had just been heard bursting from the bowels of the rock. But when Le Renard raised his voice in a long and intelligible whoop, it was answered by a spontaneous yell from the mouth of every Indian within hearing of the sound. The clamorous noises again rushed down the island, and before Duncan had time to recover from the shock, his feeble barrier of brush was scattered to the winds. The cavern was entered at both its extremities, and he and his companions were dragged from their shelter and borne into the day, where they stood surrounded by the whole band of the triumphant Hurons.